day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, I'm really glad you've decided to join us. So I hope you're staying cool this summer, or finding some way to stay cool, because it has been pretty hot outside. Last week, Metro Detroit tied another record high for temperature, a mark that was previously set way back in 1933. And that was not an isolated weather incident. This summer, we have continuously experienced record high temperatures all over Southeast Michigan. That trend of rising temperatures is important because it has effects far beyond us sweating it out during the summer. Extreme heat actually kills more Americans each year on average than hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, and lightning combined. And higher temperatures worsen a lot of other types of disasters. Think of all the crazy storms we had last year. Think of the heat waves we endure, the floods, the droughts, all kinds of negative weather dynamics. This also has a pretty big financial burden on us in this country. Last year, we experienced 20 separate billion-dollar weather and climate disasters, the second most all-time behind, well, guess about it, 2020, just the year before. And that year, extreme weather cost U.S. taxpayers $99 billion in total. And let's be honest, these effects have a disproportionate impact on certain communities. If you live in a city. Also, if you live in a community that has a high percentage of black and brown people. These problems look really different. The way that we have polluted our environment is different depending on your zip code. And, of course, we know why all of this is happening. We know that the increases in greenhouse gas emissions added by people have significantly increased temperatures and climate all over the planet. Now, fortunately, prior lawmakers gave us a tool to try to deal with this exact issue. In 1970, as a result of heightened public concerns about deteriorating city air and water contamination, remember that the Cleveland River used to catch on fire, Congress created the Environmental Protection Agency. And they were understanding that the legislature didn't have the time, the knowledge, or dexterity to foresee and fix every potential future issue. So they gave the EPA a really broad set of directives, including the Clean Air Act, which granted the EPA the ability to impose limits on pollution sources based on the, quote, best system of emissions reduction. Now, yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the ability of the EPA to reduce these kinds of emissions in a case called West Virginia versus Environmental Protection Agency. And this represents just the latest in a series of historically expansive Supreme Court decisions that reduce bodily autonomy. They have vastly expanded gun rights and further eroded the separation of church and state. It has been quite a few weeks as the Supreme Court has wrapped up its current term. But with the stakes as high as they have ever been for our planet and our health on the planet, I think it's really crucial that we take some time to really try to understand how this latest decision affects our ability to address climate change and how it looks different for those of us who live in communities like Detroit and Southeast Michigan. That is where we begin the conversation today. And we've got two really, really knowledgeable experts with us to help us understand what this ruling means and where we go from here. Nick Schreck is the Associate Dean of Experiential Education and an associate professor who specializes in environmental law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. He also joins us pretty frequently here on Detroit Today to talk about climate and environmental issues. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Stephen.
Also with us is Jeremy Orr. He is the Director of Litigation and Advocacy Partnerships at Earth Justice and an expert in environmental law. Jeremy Orr, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I want to start here. Let's just explain to listeners what was at issue in this case, West Virginia versus EPA. Nick, I'll start with you.
Sure. So this actually goes back a ways. So back in 2007, there was a case called Massachusetts v. EPA that found that EPA does have the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And then from then, you started to see EPA trying to pass these rules, these regulations to actually do that work. Back in the Obama administration, there was something called the Clean Power Plan that people may remember. And that was a proposal to really, you know, shift the way electricity is generated in this country from primarily coal to other sources like wind and solar, but also natural gas, you know, to try and reduce some of those greenhouse gas emissions. Well, that Clean Power Plan under the Obama administration was stayed by the Supreme Court, meaning they didn't allow it to be implemented. And then after the election, when President Trump was elected, Trump's EPA went ahead and drafted their own plan to try and get at these greenhouse gas emissions. And then that plan was almost immediately stopped by the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court. And then we get in now into the Biden administration, and they said that they're planning on coming up with their own rules to actually regulate greenhouse gas emissions. But before they could do that, the Supreme Court decided to take a crack at looking at EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act, as you said in the opening. And this question of, you know, whether EPA has the authority to act as broadly as they were doing under that Clean Power Plan back in 2016. Now, just at the outset, I want to note that it was extraordinary for EPA to even take this case because the Biden administration had not put out a rule yet. They hadn't released anything that could actually be reviewed. So this was basically the court going back, looking at the Clean Air Act, saying, you know, here's what we think EPA's authority should be, rather than really looking at, you know, what Congress had intended and how these regulations have evolved over time. So it was kind of extraordinary they took this case to begin with. And then, as you mentioned, you know, they looked at this question of, you know, what is the best system for emission reductions across the country. And my sort of overall upshot of the ruling is that it could have been worse. I was concerned, as well as were many others, I'm sure Jeremy was as well, that the Supreme Court may have said, you know what, we're going to take a look at whether greenhouse gases can even be regulated, or we're going to severely limit the authority of agencies to act in many different areas, not just EPA, but other federal agencies. Based on these recent decisions that they've had on abortion and prayer in schools and all of that, we were really worried that they were going to just take a hatchet completely to the Clean Air Act and to EPA's authority in other areas. So this is just sort of limited to this electrical power generation and how EPA can regulate those facilities. But it's still a very disappointing, disheartening decision because we are so far behind the curve on where we need to be on regulating greenhouse gas emissions. And this just, you know, sets us back, right? It's more of a delay. There's still some authority there for EPA to act that we can get into, but definitely bad. But as I said, it could have been, you know, worse. And I think we have to take a little bit of solace in that we can continue to kind of try and move forward and really tackle this increasingly devastating problem of climate change.
So Jeremy Orr, talk about the practical implications of what the court says. As I was saying in the open, those of us who live in urban centers, those of us who live in majority black and brown communities, put up with a lot of the effects of climate change. I would say a lot more when it comes to pollution than many other places. What does it mean to say that the EPA cannot regulate climate change in this way?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, this will have some significant implications, and despite it being not as, you know, as burdensome as we thought it would be, right, it's still a pretty significant environmental ruling. You know, what it does is, as you know, Dick mentioned, right, it limits EPA's, you know, power significantly to impact the future of regulation as well, right? And when we think about, you know, the practical implications on communities, right, not just communities in Detroit, but communities around the country, they're going to be, you know, they're going to be pretty significant from a practical standpoint of, you know, EPA not being able to regulate in certain ways, you know, because of this, you know, kind of, which we'll maybe get into this major questions document. Right. It shifts responsibility to the state. That's one of the more important things. Right. And when we talk about shifting responsibility to the state, as we've seen this division around, you know, political and economic and social issues, we're going to have some states, right, that are going to step up. They're going to strengthen rules. They're going to strengthen standards. And you're going to have a lot of states that on their own decide not to do much of anything. Right. And I think, as you've mentioned, the direct implications, particularly on marginalized communities, communities of color, low income communities, we know that those communities are two times more likely to be overburdened with air pollution. Right. The science and the data shows that people who live in these areas tend to experience respiratory diseases at much higher rates. And as we think about, you know, the Clean Air Act being created to remedy these issues and using that enforcement to remedy these issues by rolling back some of this enforcement authority, right, we're only going to heighten exposure to air pollution, particularly in communities of color and low-income communities. And then, you know, when we look at African-American populations who are consistently overrepresented with the poorest air quality, they're going to be hit pretty hard.
Yeah. Nick, I want to talk just a little more about the ruling here, mm-hmm. and the thinking behind it.
Right.
Jeremy mentioned this major questions issue, which right. is kind of an obscure doctrine of the Supreme right. Court, at least for most people. But talk about how this has been a struggle that's gone on for a really long time, not just in environmental law, but lots of regulatory spaces. But what is it that the court is kind of thinking about here and addressing by pulling the reins back on the EPA this way?
Well, this major questions doctrine, this is something that, you know, first appeared in, at least in a Supreme Court opinion, back in 2000. And it was when FDA was attempting to regulate tobacco. And the court said, you know, Congress didn't give FDA the specific authority, the Food and Drug Administration, to regulate tobacco. This is a major question that should, you know, Congress, in order to delegate their authority, you know, all the power that they have, that they give to these federal agencies to implement laws, pass regulations, et cetera, they can't delegate that authority on something as major as, you know, regulating tobacco unless Congress says they should. Now, so with the Clean Air Act, and this is a much more interesting question, because the whole purpose of the act is, as you said, Stephen, is to, you know, clean up the air, right? We had horrible air pollution. You had the smog people couldn't see through in LA, you know, very, very harmful air emissions prior to the Clean Air Act. And so that was the whole purpose of the law. And you had Congress recognizing that they were not the experts, right? They were going to go out and hire and find the best engineers and modelers and scientists to actually figure out what were safe levels of pollution that we could have out there in the ambient air around us, and then pass regulations to make sure that we didn't cross any thresholds that could be very harmful to human health and to the environment. And by the way, so we can see things like across the Detroit River into Windsor, so we can see beautiful, we could actually look at the Grand Canyon. I mean, national parks are important in this conversation too. Like, you know, all of these aesthetic things that we value, that all kind of falls under the Clean Air Act. So here you've got the court saying, you know what, we have now a majority of this Supreme Court that they've really grown up in their legal career thinking that the administrative state or all of these federal agencies have become too powerful, have asserted too much authority in areas that, you know, really should appropriately be in the purview of Congress. And so they're trying to rein that back in. But, you know, to cut through all this, I'll just say flat out, a lot of this has to do with money. Okay. The Clean Power Plan back in 2016 was going to be expensive. Now, it would save a lot of money and reduced hospital visits and reduced asthma, you know, fewer kids getting asthma from air pollution. It would have saved a ton of money from a health perspective. And it would have provided all these environmental benefits, but it would have been expensive to, you know, transition away from coal more quickly. And so I think a lot of this has to do with money. It's a question of, you know, whether Congress has specifically spoken on this issue. And then one other elephant in the room that we thought would come up in this case is something called Chevron deference. Mm-hmm. Chevron is an oil company, but there was a case where there's a question of how EPA could fill gaps in. You know, Congress passes a law. They don't answer every single question in regard to how EPA should do their job. Can EPA permissibly, you know, interpret the statute and then pass regulations? And that's called Chevron deference. Again, there's probably now a majority on the court that wants to do away with this Chevron deference. And if they do, then that calls into question of like how much power do agencies actually have to act, or do they have to wait for a specific line by line instruction from Congress? And the problem there is that Congress is dysfunctional, right? We don't pass these kind of laws. We don't have the type of searching inquiry within Congress that gets us to effective regulations. And so that's really what was at issue here was, you know, the power of EPA, the power of agencies in general, and a court that really wants to rein that in. And I think most of that has to do with economic reasons, right? They want to give a nod to the oil industries, the coal industries, a lot of the people that are big funders of conservative politicians. Yeah. And that's a lot of what's going on here.
Yeah. I'm talking with Nick Schreck, who is Associate Dean of Experiential Education and Associate Professor at the Detroit Mercy School of Law. Also with us is Jeremy Orr, who is Director of Litigation and Advocacy Partnerships at Earth Justice. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in West Virginia versus EPA, where the court, by a pretty significant majority, rolls back a lot of the power that the EPA has to regulate coal plants, to regulate other kinds of things that that are contributing to climate change, that are making the air dirty, that are making the planet warmer, and that are having such a profound effect on communities like ours here in Southeast Michigan. Think of all of the things that pollute our air, our soil, our water here in Southeast Michigan, and the profound efforts to try to rein some of those things in that the EPA has made over time. The U.S. Supreme Court is now saying that even Congress cannot deed the EPA that kind of power. We want to hear from you during the conversation as well. Do you believe that the court ruled correctly in this case? Do you believe the EPA should maybe not have authority to regulate carbon emissions in the way that the Obama and Biden administrations imagined that they could? Give us a call and tell us what you think about the environment and the climate where we live here in Southeast Michigan, things that pollute, again, the air and the soil and the water where we live. Give us a sense of how you would react to this ruling at the polls. We're all going to go and elect new congressional representatives in the fall and many other local posts. Does this influence the way that you might vote? Also, give us a call and let us know if you're somebody who lives with a fair amount of pollution. Do you live in Southwest Detroit, for instance, zip codes that routinely end up on the lists of the most polluted places in the United States? 313-577-1019 is always the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today. We'll work into the conversation. Also, this is the end of the Supreme Court's term. These are the last opinions that came down yesterday. What do you think of the flurry of opinions that we got over the last few weeks? The abortion ruling, the gun rights ruling, the ruling about school prayer. The court is envisioning a very different America, the very different set of individual liberties and regulatory schemes than we've lived under for a really long time. Give us a sense of what you think of that. Are you in favor of it, or do you think this has got us all headed in the wrong direction? Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will get to your calls and your social media comments. We'll also, of course, keep Jeremy Orr and Nick Schreck. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We're talking about the Supreme Court ruling in a case called West Virginia versus Environmental Protection Agency. This was a ruling that came down this week that really gutted the EPA's ability to regulate the causes, many of the causes of climate change, the kinds of industrial pollution that we put up with an awful lot in communities like Detroit. Our guests are Jeremy Orr, who is Director of Litigation and Advocacy Partnerships at Earth Justice. We've also got Nick Schreck here. He is Associate Dean of Experiential Education and Associate Professor at the U of D Mercy Law School. We want to hear from you as well. What do you think of this ruling? What do you think of the idea of limiting the scope of government power to deal with climate change? Do you think that's the right direction to go, that the EPA is too aggressive and hurting businesses that make money off of things that pollute the air and the soil and water? Or do you think that this is a terrible mistake and something that will lead to more pollution and the side effects of that pollution that that we experience so profoundly here in Detroit? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work into the conversation. Especially want to hear from people who live in areas here in Southeast Michigan where you experience the side effects of this pollution. Folks in Southwest Detroit, I think, come to mind pretty readily when you think of that. But there are lots of areas here because of our heavy reliance on industry here. There are lots of places where pollution defines the way that we breathe, defines the way we have to clean water and clean the soil. Call and tell us what those experiences look like for you. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. Nick Schreck, before we get to our listeners, I do want to give you a chance to talk about the really practical end of this ruling. Sometimes we think of the court doing something and it seems abstract what the effect on our individual lives might look like. Here in Southeast Michigan, we don't have to imagine mm-hmm. those things. We can point to very specific places and very specific actions that government might have been considering that now won't be possible.
Right. And, you know, there was actually one benefit of the Clean Power Plan that was realized from back in 2016 is that some utility companies started planning as if that rule would be upheld, right, and would be enforced. And so they started looking at retiring some of their older coal-fired power plants. You know, one example would be the Detroit Edison DTE River Rouge facility. I mean, that plant was older, inefficient, but is not, you know, has been shut down in part because of these regulations that we thought were going to be in place. And so that has, you know, again, good air quality benefits for people living anywhere downwind of that facility. And, you know, the thing about air pollution, it's, yes, it gets up into the atmosphere and is dispersed. We see high levels of ozone and other pollutants on the west side of Michigan. You know, Muskegon often has very poor air quality from pollution blowing across the lake from Indiana and from Illinois. But people that live next to these facilities are just socked with outsized amounts of pollution. And so one of the things the Clean Power Plan was attempting to do was to, you know, shut down those older, heavily polluting facilities in these neighborhoods, in these residential areas that could, you know, dramatically improve health for people. And so that's, I mean, when you talk about like what does this type of ruling do, it means that it can kind of shift some of that focus and can slow down our progress towards renewable sources of energy, cleaner sources of energy that, you know, not only help limit greenhouse gas emissions to have a healthier climate, but also just have those real benefits of reduced asthma, reduced heart attacks, breathing difficulty, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Jeremy Orr, of course, this affects the clients that you have at Earth Justice as well, and the work that you do on their behalf. Tell our listeners just a little more about what on the ground that looks like and what it'll look like because of this ruling.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we think about is, you know, EPA was invested with this authority to regulate, pollution under the Clean Air Act. And if we're saying we're stripping away some of that authority, particularly as it relates to power plants, which is one of the most significant, emitters of pollution. I think it's number two behind transportation on greenhouse gas and carbon dioxide. We're talking about stripping our partners and communities and clients of the ability to either compel EPA to regulate in ways that are necessary to protect public health or even challenge you know, our polluting facilities in our communities that aren't entertainment, right, that are causing this harm to public health and environmental health, right? So when we think about our clients and partners and communities who bear the brunt and the burden of environmental degradation and pollution, we're not just stripping EPA of a tool to regulate. We're also looking at potentially stripping our communities of the few legal tools that they even have to bring, you know, cases to protect their own health and well-being.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. You can also go to social media, Facebook or Twitter, put comments there, and we can include you in the show that way. Ed on Twitter says, I'm even more afraid of next term, the Clean Water Affirmative Action States' Rights to Change Voting Rights. 6-3, he says, seems to be a trend. That is what the conservative majority looks like right now on the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's go to the phones and start with Benjamin in Sterling Heights. Benjamin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Uh-huh.
What we're witnessing is, in my opinion, I think many others may share this, is it's been a slow motion judicial coup of the court system. This is the culmination of decades of planning and federal and Supreme Court appointments that have been getting built up over the past several decades. This is what McConnell and the rest of the GOP have been building for.
Mm-hmm.
And this is finally them reaping the fruits of that labor. And I realize that the focus today is the environmental side of the equation. And it frankly baffles me. They're making rulings that aren't rooted in reality. The Supreme Court isn't making decisions that make any degree of sense. It's in the name of the agency, Environmental Protection Agency.
It's pretty literal.
And I guess my question is, if not the EPA, then who? It was mentioned earlier that that Congress can't give the EPA this authority, but if we're dealing with power plants, can't like the Department of Energy then be granted this authority? What is the next solution?
Yeah, it's
because
a great.
I don't see one.
It's a great question, Benjamin, and I think if, especially for people who don't spend a lot of time following the court or trying to sort through its various doctrines, this does seem kind of puzzling in terms of whether it's saying we can't regulate these things at all. Nick Schreck, what's the answer there?
Well, first, just to be clear, I mean, the court didn't say that EPA could never, you know, regulate power plants in this way, just that the existing language in the Clean Air Act, in the court's view, doesn't give them the broad authority that they were seeking to exercise. So Congress could clean that up, right? They could amend the Clean Air Act, you know, let's take bets on how quickly that'll happen, right? I mean, you know, you've got an evenly divided Senate with Senator Joe Manchin, also from the great state of West Virginia, that was the lead plaintiff in this litigation. So, you know, seeing something make it through the House and Senate and then be signed by President Biden that is, you know, proactively tackling climate change or greenhouse gas emissions, I think is a long shot. So what do we do in the interim, right? So great question. Well, as we talked about, you know, the states have some authority. You know, Michigan can act above and beyond the requirements of the Clean Air Act to regulate pollution and to promote our health and the health of the environment. They have to do that in ways that don't directly conflict with federal law. So you have to be a little bit creative. There may be more opportunities for nuisance type suits, that kind of, we call it, you know, common law type cases where these are, you know, a property owner suing another over pollution. So neighbors suing a facility for polluting their land. And then there's some other things that EPA can still do. You know, they can require different types of fuels or different mixes or blends. So maybe instead of burning only coal, they have to co-fire the plant with natural gas. Now, the problem there is that we're still emitting greenhouse gas emissions, but it would be lower, right? They can do some other things, you know, in regulating the facilities themselves. What the court said is that they can't just have this sort of national plan to, you know, they call it beyond the fence line, right? So a plan to just for the whole country to say, we're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by X percent under this existing authority. So that means Congress has to act. They have to pass something like was proposed in 2008 or 2009, the Waxman-Markey or the climate bill, or they have to amend the Clean Air Act in some other way. We definitely need that. But I'll just say in your comment about the Supreme Court, I mean, I agree with that, right? This has been intentional. It's been, you know, identifying people who, some of these groups that sort of vet judicial candidates, the Federalist Society is the main one, on the conservative side, they're identifying people to put up in the Court of Appeals and in the Supreme Court that have a philosophy, you know, kind of, you know, in line with, again, limiting agency action to do things, you know, perhaps, you know, taking us back, you know, many, many hundreds of years in some cases, you know, and I'll leave it with saying, you know, think about how silly it would be if you look at something like the Dobbs opinion overturning Roe v. Wade, and you look at how they're relying on, you know, British common law cases and cases from early American jurisprudence. You know, what would they have said about climate change back then, right? I mean, let's get real here, right? Like they didn't know about it, they weren't thinking about it, but now we know a lot better, and we have the tools to effectively regulate, and we can't just be always, you know, oh, we need to look back at what the historical record said, because a lot of these things are new. They're new technologies. They're new things that are harming people today, and agencies have to have the ability to regulate, or we're just going to continue to have pollution that's going to continue warming the planet on and on and on.
Yeah. So quickly, Michael on Twitter has a specific question about this. He says, good news for Michigan, DTE has fully bought into moving from coal to natural gas-fired plants and wind and solar. We've had arguments about the timelines there, but Nick, do you trust that DTE won't use this ruling to backtrack, to back away from some of the commitments that it's already made?
Well, I, you know, certainly would like to take them at their word, but what the truth will be shown in their regulatory filings. So they do these things called integrated resource plans, where they talk about what their electric generation mix will be going forward. You know, Consumers Energy, you know, they should get a lot of credit here too. They've been, you know, aggressively moving away from coal and into cleaner sources of energy. But, you know, I'll just say this as a veteran of the renewable energy wars in Michigan going back, you know, 15 years, I'll say that, you know, without a state law requiring a certain percentage of our electricity to come from renewable sources, the utilities weren't just doing that voluntarily. Now they are moving as wind energy in particular in Michigan continues to get cheaper. You know, you are seeing a transition to that as a generating source. I mean, we really need to focus on solar. This is just a quick soapbox thing here. I mean, you know, getting rooftop solar going in Michigan in an aggressive way is something that the utilities have actually resisted. But that's what we really need to do. We need more of this, you know, diversified generation of electricity. And so yeah, I mean, I think it's great that they're making some of those pronouncements, but at the same time, they're actually funding lobbyists and working in certain regulatory arenas to kind of undermine the authority. So they say a lot of great things publicly, and I think they are going to try and meet these renewable energy targets. But at the same time, they're also trying to reduce regulations on them in the meantime. I would say maybe the old like trust but verify, right? Like we'll listen to them say, take them at their word, but we need to verify it through their regulatory filings and how they actually operate.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, or I wonder if you can talk about what some of the, I guess, the litigation options might be here other than or outside the arena of congressional action. Nick was talking about how it's going to be, it'll be difficult to get Congress to revisit this in a way that would restore some of this authority. Is it something that organizations like Earth Justice can pursue more through the courts, and are there other avenues to try to move the ball forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and even going back, you know, to the court's role in this, right? I think which came up in the prior question of the Supreme Court. One thing that we're highly cognizant of is this was a case that this court didn't even have to take and was questionable whether they even had jurisdiction over, right? Because typically, when the court takes a case, there's what we call a controversy or question, right? So we're talking about a clean power plan that was you know, promulgated under Obama, that was removed under the Trump administration. So this court decided on a case that wasn't actually a case, right? Mm-hmm. A case or a controversy. So that's the first thing when we think about the ability of the courts to pull this work within their jurisdiction. So that's one. But then so now as we're shifting to what legal remedies do we have, right? As Nick mentioned, right, I think for many of us, we were a bit surprised that, you know, the act wasn't gutted completely. It was a little narrowly tailored, and it was predominantly focused on the role of EPA in regulating power plants. And in particular, and I think as Nick mentioned, right? The need to shift to different forms of generation. That's what this case was about. It was about whether EPA could regulate generation shifting, right? So essentially, can they regulate and put caps or criteria on moving from, you know, coal fire and oil to natural gas and clean gas, right? So that's what the case was limited to. But as Nick mentioned as well, there are, you know, there's still ways that we can do that, right? Through the legislative process, rulemaking process. But as we think about the tools in our toolbox for continuing to protect communities around the country, right, and in particular in Detroit, you know, there are still rules in place, right? There are still compliance mechanisms. There are still air quality standards, right, that are still in place, that when we think of our clients on the ground, communities on the ground, that we can still, you know, file cases. We can still make complaints. We can still petition EPA to bring these polluters to justice and protect our communities. We just now realize that with this case, right, that broader shift, you know, institutional shift that we need may not be available in this form.
And if I, Steve, yeah, if I could ahead. Just jump in to say with what Jeremy was saying, that things like particulate matter. So those are the fine particles that are emitted when you burn coal. There's regulations that, you know, limit the amount of particulate matter that can be released. Well, if we can continue ratcheting down particulate matter pollution, that then will also convince some of these utilities that, you know what, maybe it's too expensive to keep, you know, burning coal. We need to transition these other sources. So there's ways that using these other pollutants that we have good, solid regulations for that, gosh, I sure hope those won't be called into question, because if they do, you know, all bets are off. You know, let's I'll move to Alaska or something. You know what I mean? And, it really is that kind of level where, like, they're going down a path here that I think is very dangerous in terms of curtailing agencies to act. And so we have to use the tools we still have in that toolbox. But unfortunately, there's one less after yesterday.
Yeah. Okay. Need to take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about the ruling on the EPA from the U.S. Supreme Court. Also want to continue to hear from you on the phones and on social media. 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter. Put comments there, and we'll work into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your place for open dialogue.
The music you love.
Real news and in-depth analysis.
And cultural experiences. The sound of Detroit.
101.9 WDET is your public radio station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in a case called West Virginia versus EPA, in which the justices really rode back some of the discretion that the EPA has in regulating pollution, essentially regulating climate change. We're talking about what effect that has. Not just on the regulatory environment in our country, but also the practical implications in places like Southeast Michigan, where we live with a disproportionate amount of pollution caused by industry. What does this mean for us as individuals who live here and who count on government to balance the interests of profit that needs to be made by the companies that manage industry, against the interests of our health, public health, individual health? Our guests are Jeremy Orr, who is a director of litigation and advocacy partnerships at Earth Justice. Also with us is Nick Schreck, associate dean of experiential education and associate professor at the U of D Mercy School of Law. We want to hear from you as well on the phones and on social media. 313-577-1019 is the number here. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. I got another social media comment I want to add here. Patrick from Royal Oak says, Reagan research led in the 80s and found that while it made us $1 million, it would cost us $1 billion in health costs and outcomes. We need to discuss the true costs of these decisions. It can always, it can't always be about profit at the expense of our health. Really good point there, Patrick. Let's go to John on the East Side. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hey. So I don't really have to tell you how I feel about the Supreme Court, but I want to share a story I heard on NPR several years ago about the EPA back in the 70s when they banned lead. And it was really interesting. The head of the EPA then was all ready to go with the lead lobbyists and continue on putting lead in house paint and gasoline and everything else. And there was a scientist who was doing studies on lead and the IQ. And there was parallel studies going on in Washington about lead or IQ and potential earnings. And the EPA director took a look at that. It had nothing to do with health consequences. It just had to do with earnings. And so I think we have to share things like this with people more and more about the cost to society versus the cost to manufacturers and corporations.
Yeah. John, great point. Jeremy Orr, I know this is a central part of the work at Earth Justice, which is, you know, fronting health and public health over the idea of profit in this space.
Yeah, that's right. In particular, as we're talking about lead, right, and the controversy still going on with that in the state, right, around the state and around the country. But this part of prioritizing people over profit is so important. Because even Michigan plays a key role in the significance of this West Virginia v. EPA case, right? There was a Michigan versus EPA case as well, right? Mm-hmm. A few years back, right? That decided, okay, if you can regulate it, but if you're going to regulate it, you have to account for the cost of it. You at least have to consider it, right? And then EPA goes, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll consider it and make rules around that. And now you still have a court saying, okay, you considered it, but we don't think you have, right, the power to make decisions that have this sort of political and economic implications, right? So I think there is a real need, right, to really prioritize health and well-being of residents over profit, because what we know, those short-term profits are far outweighed by the long-term cost as it relates to all of these public health issues, be it water, be it air, hazardous waste and so on.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go to Frank in Livonia. Frank, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Stephen. You know, I just want to say that, you know, industrial people don't make pollution just for the fun of making pollution. They make pollution because they're making goods that we as consumers buy. And it's the same thing when, you know, when Congress acts, you know, they could write these laws very specifically, but we as voters, you know, need to go out and vote for Congress people that are willing to, and we don't do that. I mean, this really, you know, really always is that's the bedrock of these problems, is the consumer and the voter, which I'm one of. And
yeah, Frank, I really appreciate that perspective, and we haven't talked much about, you know, the responsibility that we all bear for putting up with and contributing to these companies that that pollute. Nick Schreck, what are things that individuals can do, I think, is one of the questions. I mean, I think people feel quite helpless to make this kind of change on their own.
Well, and it's difficult. I mean, the caller makes a great point about, yes, I mean, we're consumers of electricity. I mean, the one difference there is that for most of us, if we want to be tied into the electric grid, we don't really have a choice about who's providing that electricity, right? Like I can't say I only want my electricity to come from wind farms, right? I'm part of this grid and a DTE customer. And so I have, you know, some limited choice there within this monopoly environment that we've got for utilities. And, there's some decent reasons for that, right? We have to pay for transmission lines, and we have to have all of that work, you know, tree trimming and stuff that needs to be done to hopefully keep the power on, which we need more of that kind of maintenance work for sure. But what can we do? So yes, we can make choices as consumers. We can you know, even think there's a public service commission in Michigan that does a lot of regulating of our utilities here in the state. They take comments. They take comments by email. You can send in and say, you know, I really want more renewable energy options, right? I want to be able to put solar on my home without a whole lot of trouble and having to jump through all these hoops. You know, advocacy there. And yes, getting people running for office on record, you know, about not only do they believe climate change is real, but what are they going to do about it, right? Are they going to pass laws to get us moving as a society in a way that leads to a healthier, sustainable future for all of us? I mean, we really need to get politicians on record and then hold them accountable. And it's hard, right? Like, where you're one voter, but you know, you talking to people, getting them and at candidate forums, you know, going through the different candidate screening processes to get these folks on record and then holding them accountable if they don't follow through. I mean, that it's got to be political pressure, and then we can also make some choices as consumers. And yes, I mean, doing things like higher efficiency appliances, insulating our homes. And there are some programs available. I should, you know, shout out for some of those efficiency programs. Talk with your utility company about whether they have some funds available to help you insulate or caulk. Do those things at your home that really saves you a lot of money. And, you know, the best electricity is the stuff that we save, that we don't even need to generate, right? Like, that's the cheapest, okay? If we can work on efficiency, that's still a really great way for us as consumers to have an impact and maybe save some money on that utility bill, too, if we're, you know, have better insulation, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, that gets to this kind of bigger question of whether some of these things can be solved by the markets themselves, right? We have control over those markets to some extent. Use and consumption are drivers of all of this. If we change those things, which I feel like we have started to in pretty significant ways, maybe the problem starts to take care of itself.
Well, and that's the hope, is that the market gets to a point where it can overcome some of the incentives and some of the sort of, you know, inside tracks that a lot of these fossil fuel companies have been given. You know, there's complaints about subsidies for wind and solar. Well, let me tell you, there's a whole heck of a lot of benefits, tax benefits and otherwise, that flow to fossil fuel companies. And when there hasn't been a level playing field there. And so, but the market, you know, with these advancements in technology, over time, renewables will keep getting cheaper, whereas fossil fuels will continue getting more expensive because they're finite resources. So you got to bet on renewables, but we need to get there faster than we are currently. And one way to do that is through certainly congressional action.
Yeah, yeah. Jeremy Orr, we've got about a minute and a half left. Talk about next steps for an organization like Earth Justice. I mean, yesterday was a day of disappointment, but not crushing disappointment, as you've pointed out. I mean, it could have been much worse. But what's the pivot here that organizations like yours will end up making to try to regroup?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple things, right, that we're thinking about. I mean, the first is, you know, as Nick mentioned, right, ensuring that we're back to the drawing board and working federally, right, to make sure that there are some rules and laws on the books that does this the right way, that hopefully can stand up in court and we continue to attack the climate crisis. The other thing is really looking at this local and state level work, where we know a lot of this power is not going to fall until this stuff gets sorted out, right? So making sure that we're working with impacted communities, local communities and partners, you know, advancing you know, climate justice oriented policies and legislation at local and state levels that can tackle this. I think that's going to be really, really critical moving forward.
Yeah. Nick, what do you make of what's next? Is there a push to get Congress to do something here, or is this kind of a move away from the regulatory idea toward, you know, other kinds of pressures?
Well, I mean, Congress has to act. I mean, and remember the Build Back Better plan, part of President Biden's agenda, and that was largely stalled by a couple senators. Mm-hmm. But I mean, a big portion of that was significant investments in renewable energy and kind of tackling the climate crisis. So we do need that action from Congress. We can't get to where we need to be with just, you know, agency regulation alone. We need a climate bill. We need a bill focused on that. But in the meantime, as Jeremy said, I mean, there's a lot that can be done at the state and local level. There's a lot of powers that our local governments have and that our state governments have to work in a positive direction. And we need to double down, redouble, triple those efforts as soon as we possibly can. And you know what? The courts, it's not, yes, we've got a majority now that I think is skeptical of environmental regulation, but all hope is not lost there either. You know, we're going to continue to litigate these cases. We're going to push as much as we can. You know, as long as there is an opportunity, a good legal principle for us to challenge, we're going to do it, right? Up and down, all across the country. Because really, this is, you know, we are a union of states, right? Like, we got 50 states, pollution doesn't respect boundaries. We need to have some federal rules here. This can't just be one state going it alone. Or some states will decide, you know what, we're going to race to the bottom. We're going to be open business for polluters, and then the rest of us will still suffer from that pollution.
Yeah. Okay, Jeremy Orr and Nick Schreck, both great to have both of you here for this conversation. Thanks so much for joining. All right, everybody have a great 4th of July weekend. I'll be back on Tuesday when we're going to talk with journalist Danny Fenster about his harrowing story, including the 6 months he spent wrongfully imprisoned in Myanmar by a military junta and his journey back home to the state of Michigan. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again next week.